Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, certain people tend to erupt in squeals at the prospect of an appearance by author Judy Blume. If you're linked to this podcast, you may be one. For the uninitiated, you should know that Blume's books are among the top best-selling children's books ever published. She has sold over 80 million books for children and young adults. Blume's books for teens were some of the first to take on race issues, menstruation, masturbation, teen sex, and divorce. She has also written best-selling books for adults, including Wifey and Smart Women. In 2000, the Library of Congress named her a living legend for her significant contributions to America's cultural heritage. Blume began writing when her children were in preschool. She published her first book, The One in the Middle is the Green Kangaroo, in 1969. Over the next decade, she published many more books, including Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Her latest novel is In the Unlikely Event. It revolves around a series of real-life plane crashes from her youth in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Judy Blume spoke in conversation with Nancy Pearl at Town Hall Seattle on June 11, 2015. The event was presented by Seattle Arts and Lectures. Thanks to Kevin Mitchum for our recording. Here, Ruth Dickey of Seattle Arts and Lectures introduces the event.
To officially open our evening, I'm proud to introduce a student from our Writers in the Schools program. This year, Writers in the Schools worked with over 6,000 students at 21 area schools and at Seattle Children's Hospital by matching them with local professional creative writers to write their own stories, poems, and memoirs. Tonight's reader, Hannah Billen, is an 11th grader at Franklin High School, and she worked with WITS writer-in-residence Margot Case this year. Hannah just wowed all of us with her essay, Love, at the year-end readings at the Seattle Public Library, and she will be reading an excerpt from that essay this evening. Please join me in welcoming Hannah.
Hi. This piece is titled Love. I love immensely. I love often. I love completely with parts of myself that are scarcely used for anything else. I might love more than I should. I've learned love through others, through people who fill me up and break me down all at once. The first person to break my heart was Carter. He wore leather jackets and had gauges in his ears. We liked doing nothing things, like rolling around in the grass or playing on playgrounds like uninvited giants. I didn't know how important smiles were until I realized that Carter was always trying to hide his. Carter taught me to feel helpless. I'm still trying to accept the feeling. He taught me about missing someone every day, every minute, even when you aren't thinking about them. But he also saved my taste in music by playing the Beatles and Oasis on his guitar. Carter showed me how music creates connections. He made me understand that time isn't always so important, that things go on even when people have to be apart. Carter taught me the kind of love that doesn't stop, no matter what. Soli taught me to take care of myself. We called each other at our breaking points and we cried. She taught me not to be shy about my talents as she belted Dear Officer Krupke from on top of a table. She showed me that sometimes we have to break down, and that's okay. With her, I could believe in the unknown. We knew how to be insane and how to be serious. I ordered my first chai latte with her, and she introduced me to the vagina monologues. We fed off of each other, me learning to be zen and to never stop singing, her learning to be free and to apply rainbow eyeshadow. We grew up in a few hours spent telling stories and lying in the sun. Soli's soul was lifetimes ahead of her small preteen body. She showed me how to connect with someone before getting to know them. She showed me that joy can be balanced with intensity. We learned about love together. Alice always knew what I was thinking. She said things like, love is not a victory march, that made me realize exactly why I was crying. She was the kind of strong woman I wanted to be. She inspired in me the courage to break the law and to ignore expectations. She taught me how to brew kombucha. We found each other just as we were beginning to crack, and together we broke apart. She taught me the value of silence and of long walks. She drew out parts of me that now consume me. In just a few hours with her, I could let go of weights I'd been dragging around for months. Alice taught me how to listen, both to myself and to others. She showed me how to dance and be free, and how to say goodbye. When I look back at myself, I see a girl looking for completion. She's uncertain and insecure. She's afraid to ask questions or to dance in front of people. She likes wearing makeup and shopping for high heels. She thinks they can fix her. She tries not to cry, but not to laugh too loud either. Sometimes, after all this growth I've done, I think I must be finished. But no matter how many times I build my heart up, no matter how many times I think I've made it, I will always fall apart again. And from the rubble of my heart, I will rebuild. I will build something taller, something stronger, something more beautiful. I forget that I'm not a problem that needs solving or an essay that just needs some edits. There's no solution, no completion in a person. There's no period or exclamation point to wrap me up. Thank you.
Isn't she wonderful? Thank you, Hannah. Last fall, when we learned at SAL headquarters that we would get to host Judy Blume this evening, our entire office of 8 women literally erupted into squeals. In the months since, I've learned that when you mention Judy Blume, this is an extremely common occurrence. Sure to top many of our summer reading lists, Judy Blume's new novel, In the Unlikely Event, is both moving and heartfelt. In one of my favorite passages, the main character, Miri, reflects on a conversation with her uncle, Henry. She writes that Miri, quote, didn't tell him how much she hated secrets, hated them with a passion. Were adults ever honest with kids? Aside from Henry, none had been honest with her, not Rusty, not Irene. They lived in a world where children, even teenagers, were protected from the truth for their own good. That's how they got out of saying anything. I love this passage because it illuminates what Judy Blume's books have been doing for over 4 decades. And across 26 books for children and adults and over 85 million books sold, pointing out the ways that adults and the world don't tell kids the truth, and stepping in to tell us herself. From the truth about our bodies, to bullying, to racism, to divorce, to disappointment, to teenage sex, Judy Blume has been our lookout, our spy into the confusing and the unexplained, our truth teller. Her books have illuminated what seemed to be unspeakable with humor, insight, clear-sightedness, and conviction. And as the New York Times wrote, Judy Blume's isn't just revered, she's revolutionary. Please join me in warmly welcoming the woman who has stood up against both shame and censorship and been a bold truth teller of the breathtaking beauty and incredible wonder of our bodies and our lives for generations, and the only author capable of dissolving both the SAL board and the SAL staff into squeals, Judy Blume.
Judy, welcome to Seattle. It's so nice to have you here and back. And
thank you so much. I hear all those words and I say, who is that they're talking about?
Oh, but we know it is. So, Judy, will you start by telling us what it was like to grow up in Elizabeth, New Jersey in the 1950s?
I thought it was the most boring, dull place in the entire world. I daydreamed only about going across the river to New York City. And all these years that I've been writing, I never, ever wanted to go back and write about the 50s or about myself, not myself, but, you know, about the teenage experience that I had. I thought the child up to age 12, in looking back at my life, that child was interesting to me. Everything was still possible and ahead of her. And the teenager, blah. But all of that changed.
And how? Why did it change? What impelled you to relive or to take a look back at those events?
Well, it's really interesting because I have no answer. Like, I'm a writer for 40-something years, and I've got this incredible story somewhere deep inside me, and I never think to write about it until 2009, January, I remember it exactly, at the Key West Literary Seminar, where we have authors come to town every January, and there's always a new theme. And that year, the theme was new voices in literature. And it was actually Rachel Kushner, who stood on stage talking about her first novel, a book that I happen to love, called mm-hmm. Telex from Cuba. And she was just talking, you know, about her mother's life in Cuba in the 50s and how her mother had told her stories about growing up in the 50s. And by the third time I heard in the 50s, it was like, boing, I've got this story to tell, and I have to tell it. And it came to me in a flash. No other book has ever come to me that way. No book will come to me that way again. But it came with characters. I won't say they were fully formed because, you know, I learn about them while I'm writing. But it came with plot. I don't even do plot. It came with structure. It came with everything. And that was over a weekend. And on Monday morning, January 2009, I started doing the research, taking me back to the story. After all, I lived there. I lived through this bizarre experience.
And maybe for the people who haven't read the book yet, we should say that bizarre experience was three plane crashes in what was then Newark Airport. Newark.
Well, it was in Elizabeth. Was,
they, right, in Elizabeth, but they were trying to land.
They were coming and going from Newark Airport, right. But the flight path was over Elizabeth. Nevertheless, none of us believed that was what it was.
Right.
Because it couldn't be coincidence. One fell a block and a half from the junior high where I was then a student. One almost came through the window of the only... we had two high schools sex segregated. My parents went to it when it wasn't sex segregated. They said right. It was because of them that they then separated the sexes. I don't know. But so through the window of the only all-girls public high school in town, just missing that, and another school, St. Mary's High School, right across the street. And the third crashed. And broke apart in the playing fields of the only orphanage in town. So if you're a kid and everything is about you anyway, you know that this isn't coincidence. You know they're out to get you.
Right, right. And it was the 50s where everybody was so paranoid about
yes.
the communists and
right.
McCarthy.
And the boys in junior high. And the reason that I had to put Miri, who becomes the, I guess, I've read this in enough reviews now, I wouldn't have known to say this, but Miri, the lead protagonist in junior high, was I had to have her there because one of the planes falls so close to the junior high, and because the boys in junior high, and this I remember as if it was yesterday. And it was.
I was just going to say that. It was yesterday.
You know, when my husband says to me, you know, this is historical fiction, I say, what, are you crazy? not historical fiction. So what if it was 60-something years ago? Who cares? It was yesterday for me, but the boys all came up with their reasons, and their reasons were had to do with flying saucers and aliens coming and zombies. Yes, we had zombies then, too. And, you know, supernatural, because... And the girls, the smart girls, and I wanted to be a smart girl, the smart girl said, it's sabotage, a very sexy and sophisticated word that I had no idea what it meant. But I agreed that it was sabotage because, and then I looked it up and then I knew it was sabotage. But, you know, who was out to get us? I don't know. And the grown-ups, and I go into all their heads in the book. I mean, you know, you meet a lot of people. As one tweet, I'll just quote this favorite tweet. I shouldn't tell this on myself because it might turn you off. This tweet says, cast of thousands, explosions, fires, more explosions. Which sounds like it should be a great action movie.
Yeah, right.
It's not that. I don't want to turn you off. It's really about people and friendships and falling in love and pain and loss.
How did you decide to tell it from those various points of view? Is that part of what came to you that day in January 2009?
Well, the three families came to me, and the fact that, and I don't think this is a spoiler, and it will help you get through the beginning of Cast of Thousands. To know that don't worry about it, don't flip back, don't make charts. It will all become clear. It will become clear to you. Everyone is intertwined.
Yes.
Everyone is connected to everyone else, and you will know that soon enough. But how did it come to me? What was your question, Nancy?
My question was, how did you decide to use the technique of getting into everybody's, the various characters' heads?
That may have been the hard part. Mm-hmm. The fun part was the 5 months of research.
Uh-huh. And so you went back and read the local newspapers about that time?
Yes. There are two now defunct newspapers. And I knew instantly that I wanted to tell this story, not only through my fictional characters, but also through the news stories, because I wanted to use the language of the 50s mm-hmm. news stories. And it's very colorful language. You know, we had no TV news
right.
coverage.
Right.
We had TV, but you didn't come home from school and switch it on, and there would be the news coverage of this. So it was up to those, they call themselves newspapermen, and the news photographers with their, George, where are you?
Right there, to your left.
Speed Graphics. I can never remember the name of the camera. Speed Graphic cameras to make you see this and feel it. And that was very, very important. And so there are a lot of newspaper stories in the book. They are all real, but they've been a little bit redone because I wanted them to have the byline Henry Ammerman, who is the young newspaper man hero in this book. He makes his name as a very young reporter reporting these tragedies. And I couldn't use the real stories because they came with other bylines.
Right.
Reporters that I feel I just know so well now. And I didn't find this out until late in the game. And I said, you know, I can't deliver this when you want it and still rewrite every single newspaper story.
Right.
And my own personal Henry Ammerman, George Cooper, stood up and said, here's my husband. I can be your Henry Ammerman. And he's a wonderful nonfiction writer, and he was able to take the stories and put them together and still use the language In fact, I'm going to Austin after here. And in Austin, I'm going to meet the daughter.
Oh, of one of them?
The daughter of one of the newspapermen. Oh. She said, did you ever come across the name Melville Shapiro when you were doing your research? And it's like, did I ever come across his name? Yes, he's my friend. He wrote, came filed to the ground like an angry, wounded bird.
Yeah.
He wrote that, and it's still in the book.
So. Oh, that's so great that reality comes together with what's in your book, which was based on reality.
But all the families, all the people telling the story are fiction.
Mm-hmm. And Henry is Mary's uncle, her beloved uncle.
Yes, he's a wonderful uncle. Every girl should have an uncle like Henry Amerman. He's wonderful.
Did you have
he
a little?
He tells her the truth.
Yes.
He wants her to know the truth when no one else will.
And that's a theme that sort of run through your books from the beginning, isn't it? I'm thinking of. Of course, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I mean, the sense that adults are not telling teenagers or children the truth. And was that something that you experienced as a child and a teen yourself, that you were frustrated about?
I mean, I think so. And especially in the 50s, really, and I came of age in the 50s. Nobody told us the truth about anything. I mean, they wanted us to be happy. And the truth was, you know, don't tell the children.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother let you read Marjorie Morningstar?
My mother, here is a great gift that my mother gave to me, both my parents.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest gift, and I've only realized this lately. My parents not only allowed me to read anything, all the books that I found on their bookshelves from the time I was 12. There were no YA books,
yes,
right? And so I was in their bookshelves early on because I was curious about what goes on in the adult world. And I don't mean just sex, I mean other things. And so they gave me this gift that reading is a good thing. It's to be celebrated. We're proud of you that you're a reader. They were readers.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing was off limits. And it was it's funny because my mother was such, one might say, overprotective, extremely anxious person. But they took me to the movies every week. They took me to the theater. Nobody ever was worried about what I was seeing. I remember once my mother said, "Did you understand that movie?" And I said, "Yes." I had no idea. None.
Sort of like the sabotage incident where you had, when you did that. Are the characters, is Margaret based on how you wished things had been for you? Do you know what I mean? I mean that Margaret has God to talk to. And
well, so did I.
And did you?
Of course.
The same way?
Yes, absolutely. In both Sally J. Freeman.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Sally, I made a lot of bargains. I'll do this if you do that. Mostly it started with Sally Friedman. That's my most autobiographical book. And even though I wrote Margaret first, I mean, in Sally, because I was separated from my beloved father for a while when we moved to Miami Beach, my mother, my grandmother, my brother, and me, because my brother was sick. And then in those days, the doctors said, oh, no, you can't spend winter in New Jersey. You have to get out. And my father was a dentist, and much like Dr. O in the new book, which I finally learned to say the title, In the Unlikely Event. I thought I would have to put it here on my arm. I'll never be able to say it. So I worried terribly. I was 9 about my father, and I believed in the way children believe, that I was completely responsible for his well-being, a huge burden, to take on at 9 years old. And because he was flying down once a month to visit us, that's how it was with, we were all mothers and grandmothers and children, and dads would come down once a month to see the family. I had to do a lot of
bargaining.
Oh, a lot of bargaining. Yes, uh-huh. And then when I wrote Margaret, I wrote Margaret first, but really, you know, that conversation with God was very much something that I had. I mean, I never told anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I never told anybody that I was responsible for my father's well-being. I knew that two of his brothers, both of his dental partners, had died in their early 40s, and I'm named for one of them. And, you know, my father was then in his early 40s that year that we called the bad year.
Wow. When you wrote "Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret," when you started your writing career, let me put it that way. Did you expect? Why did you? Let me back up a few steps. What made you sit down to write your first book? Do you remember? Is it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I had been a really creative kid in school, so as long as I had that outlet, I was okay. But I married young, like most of my generation. I was still in college, and I had two babies before I was 25. And I liked taking care of them. That mm-hmm. was great. But I was missing something, really missing something that I needed. I was sick all through my 20s. Until I started to write. And it could have been anything, I think, but because I was at home taking care of two little kids, that's what I could do mm-hmm. at home. And it worked out pretty well.
I didn't know anything then.
I had no idea. I mean, my biggest fantasy dream was that someday I'll be published, you know. It didn't go really any farther than that.
And did you think that those books were you forever, for example, or Wifey? I mean, did you feel that you were kind of impacting the way society, having an impact, I hate using impacting as a verb, that you were having an impact on the way society was looking at girls and maturity and things like that? I mean, or was it just really expressing
things?
I'd
love to tell you yes, but the answer is not. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. And so I just did what came naturally and spontaneously.
Well, I
didn't think, which I think is a good thing for a writer.
Yes, that's what I was
really
going to say.
I think it's best for a writer not to sit around thinking what you're going to do or how you're going to do it.
Or the effect it's going to have on your readers.
Effect that it's going to have on your readers, that's the worst thing you can possibly think of. No. And I mean, when you're talking Forever and Wifey, that was 76 and 78. Right. So that was after I had written a lot of
children's
books for,
middle grade.
What they're now called tweens and middle mm-hmm. grade chapter books. But then, you know, they were children's books.
Were there books that influenced you as a child that you remember, children's books from that era as well?
Well, I can tell you the books that most inspired me when I started to write.
Mm-hmm.
And because I went to the library. I went to the library.
The library, yes. I think we should clap about that.
And I came home with, you know, armloads of books, and I would put them in piles at night when the kids were asleep, and I would read them. These I love, these I don't want to write. And the ones that I love so much and the ones I can remember falling off the sofa laughing over Beverly Cleary. She is such a gem. I loved Beverly Cleary. And the first book that Elaine Konigsberg wrote, E.L. Konigsberg, mm-hmm. which has a title that's so long I can't even remember it, but it ends with "And Me, Elizabeth."
Right.
You know,
Hecate.
Jennifer Hecate,
right.
William McKinley,
and me,
and
Elizabeth.
Me, Elizabeth. Right.
Right.
I really like that book very much, and Harriet Spy.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the books that most inspired me when I started to write. And the books that I loved when I was young, you know, I did love the Maud Hart Lovelace books.
Me too.
Betsy Tacy books. Oh, they're wonderful.
Oh, they're
don't
so...
know them.
They're all in print.
And they're in print, and I don't know how many years ago now, when they decided to bring them back and put them into new editions, a group of women writers, it was known that many women writers had grown up on these books and had loved them. And so we were each asked to write an introduction. And so my introduction was to one of the very young ones, because Betsy and Tacy and Tib meet when they're like 5 years old.
Yes.
And it goes through Betsy's wedding.
Yes.
And I locked myself in my little office that day or that weekend to read them all again, because I was afraid to. In fact, I never gave them to my own daughter.
Really?
Which, why, I don't know. Maybe I was afraid that they wouldn't hold up. So I was afraid to read them. And I came out at the end of the day just sobbing, because they were still there for me.
They're so wonderful.
So good. Those are the books I liked.
Have you ever been, you know, there's a Betsy Tacy Society.
I know. There's a house.
I have to say, I had lunch at Betsy's house, at Tacy's house, where you can look over and see Betsy's house right across the street.
Yeah.
It was just so wonderful. And Betsy would make company dinners, do you remember? She had to learn company
Sunday
dinners.
Sunday night lunches, yes, right. I remember.
Right. Onion sandwiches. Well, let's... Now, what about... When you wrote Forever, was that... did that come out of...
No.
You said I could ask you anything.
You can. But here's why I wrote Forever.
Yes.
One of the worst reasons to ever write a book is because my then 14-year-old daughter was reading books that a librarian friend of mine called the Pregnant Books, in which if two kids do it, the girl has to be punished. Sometimes she dies. She's sent away. Mm-hmm. Something bad happens. Boys have no feelings. Girls have no sexual interest, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, what a terrible message for my own daughter to be reading. And she said to me, Mom, could there ever be a book about two nice kids and they do it and nobody dies? And so that book is dedicated to her. That's what gave me the reason to write it.
Now, is that the daughter who grew up to be a commercial airline pilot?
She did grow up to be a commercial airline pilot, which is very strange because she's a reader. And when she, of course, she heard me talking about this new book in the unlikely event. And when she read an early draft, she said, I can't believe you never told me this story.
Yeah.
And I can't believe it either. There she was, a commercial airline pilot. And I never told her, guess what happened in my town when I was growing up? I never told my husband. I will tell anybody anything. Always. And it's not that I forgot the story. I never told it to anyone.
Do you think you just blocked it out in some way, that it didn't come to sort of consciousness when you were thinking about childhood or until that time that it did finally?
I think maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I just... You know, I'd have to lay back on the sofa and we'd have to discuss this, but we don't have time because our time would be up.
Oh, I don't know.
I just think...
We can get a couch up here.
That it was there. It was always there. But it Yeah, I mean, why didn't I write about it?
Right.
I don't know.
Well, you know, it was such a traumatic incident, you know, so traumatic to children. I mean, not just the fact that the crashes happened, but they were so close to their schools, and kids died in those, you know, in apartments. And,
yes.
You know, pilots avoided, you know, tried to land the plane as far away from the places where people were living.
Yes.
I mean, it was very hard for Miri in the book to...
Yeah, but because it's a very, I mean, it's, you know, a very built-up residential area
mm-hmm.
that they came over.
Right.
They weren't always able to do that. It's a crazy story. If I made it fiction, you know, it is fiction.
Right.
But if I invented the three plane crashes, you would all think Judy has totally lost
right.
it.
In a short amount, it occurred in a...
58 days.
58
days.
Right. And I wasn't even aware till I read the book that there were these flights, non-scheduled flights, non-skeds.
Non-scheduled flights. So a way to try to get you to understand that, I've discussed this a lot with Henry Ammerman, who's over there, get kind of like cheap charters. You know, you call up, you want the cheapest plane possible. And now, not all three of them were non-skeds. I mean, we have one non-sked, one American, and one national. But the first one was a non-sked, and it was an Army surplus plane from the Second World War. And, non-sked. So here's the crazy thing. Okay, so my father, who was really a dentist and was really called in to identify victims by their dental records because that was all the only way that they could, this is what he's doing at night. And when I'm a senior in high school, my father takes me to Boston to interview college interviews. And on the way back, there's a snowstorm, and our flight was canceled. But my father comes trotting out with two tickets and says, I can get us back, and, you know, we're going to fly home tonight just the way we're supposed to. And on the plane back, you know, it was with my father. I adored him. I trusted him completely. I was safe. I was with Daddy. On the way home, he leans close and he says, and never, ever tell your mother I took you on a non-sked. And I never did. She lived to be 84, and I never told her. But I did write about this, and it's not a spoiler, I think, to tell you that there is a brief scene in the book where Dr. O, who is the dentist, and the only character who is, you know, loosely, really inspired by my own father, kind of the good dentist everybody loves. So he takes his son, Steve, to Boston for college interviews. And on the way back, it snows.
Right.
And he says, wait right here. And he comes back and he says, look, I've scored two tickets on the way home. And on the way home, he leans close and says, and never, ever tell your mother I took you on a non-sked. Unlike me, Steve thinks to himself, he's taking me, his only son, on a non-sked when he's going every night to the morgue to identify victims, because Steve is 18 the year that this is all happening. With me, there were a few years in between. And so, yeah, I did get to use that. But Steve isn't as kind and loving about his father as I was.
No. So I'm going to continue talking to Judy, but if you have questions that you'd like to ask, if you want to write them down and pass them to the aisles, they will be collected. I guess that's an L I need in that word, collected. So one of the characters in the book that I thought was so interesting and tragic in a way was Natalie. Was she based on somebody?
No. I never knew a Natalie. No. Natalie goes cuckoo. I really didn't know anyone like Natalie,
uh-huh.
But it was great fun to, well, I won't say
fun. Yeah.
It was interesting to create Natalie and to see where she was going to go. I did not know on that Sunday when, you know, the light bulb popped over my head and I knew I had a book that I had, a story that I had to tell, and it came with all the characters. I knew that there would be a Natalie. I didn't know her name. But I didn't know any of what was going to happen to her.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, given the relative openness of our lives today, that books for children and teens can have as much of an impact as yours did when there wasn't that much openness?
I certainly hope so.
I mean, they can still be fun and everything, but your books changed I think it could be argued that your books changed a generation, educated a generation. Would you agree, guys?
But you know, there's always that one right book. You know this.
Yes, I do. But I love to hear it from you.
There is always that one book put into the hands of a child who needs it at that time by someone who recognizes that that child needs this book. And that book will change a life. And it doesn't matter how open we are or, you know, social media or anything else. There's still that story that will stay inside that, not just child, but person.
Right.
I think of any age. But, you know, I think that's what books do.
Well, what can
it's
I say after that?
It's what I want them to do anyway. I think they do. I mean, I love getting lost in a good book. And I know that for me, it was a really good book when I close it and I finished with it, but I'm still thinking about those characters for a long time. Mm-hmm. I can remember the characters. Not the plot. I don't care about that, as my critics will tell you, but the characters.
Right.
The characters, thinking about them. That's what I hope every time I, you know, have a new baby to send out there to readers, that you'll come away thinking about the characters. They'll stay with you.
Well, so in Seattle this summer, we're going to all play bingo.
I heard that.
Yes. So, what are your reading plans for the summer?
Oh, I am so thrilled to be done with this book. You have no idea. And I'm going to be on tour, because I'm going to the UK too, until July 22nd. And then I'm going to sleep a lot, and I'm going to read, because while I'm writing fiction, 5 years.
Yeah.
5 years. It's not that I haven't read a book in 5 years, but when I'm writing fiction, it is very dangerous for me to read fiction, because if it's good, I'm intimidated, and I think the little voice goes off.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know what you're doing. It's true.
I know.
You know, and so you have to go into that little room and you have to, you know, kick the critic off this shoulder and the censor off that shoulder and just be there with your characters. And if I let other people's characters in with me, that's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. I learned that the hard way, in case you were wondering.
Can you expand on that?
I was writing Smart Women, and I was living for a brief time on in Venice, California, on that Marina Peninsula, whatever that peninsula is, for a few months because my husband hurt himself and he needed rotator cuff surgery. Anyways. And while I was there, William Wharton, who wrote Birdie, had a new book out called Dad. I don't know if any of you ever read William Wharton. He was pretty wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so, because I had loved Birdie, I I jumped up and I took
Dad.
And it was a big book. And I read it all at once. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't write. It was good. It was so good. And I was so involved with the characters. And for 3 months, I couldn't write on mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't do that anymore.
Yeah. So who's on your to-be-read list, if I may ask?
Oh, there are so many good books. I can't wait. Right now, on the planes, I have to say I'm taking 17 planes right now around America. I'm crossing them off. I'm not at all afraid to fly, by the way. I couldn't wait to fly. I was 17 when I had my first flight, and I was extremely excited. Flying was so exciting then, and it was very different. So don't be afraid to take the book on a plane. Don't be afraid. You know, we're talking the early 50s. Everything was different. You know, there was a lot of pilot error. There was a lot of mechanical failure. And we're much better than that now. So I'm taking 17 planes. And on the planes, I'm trying to read something by every author who will be sitting in
your chair. Oh, so, yes.
Something that every one who's going to interview me has.
So Jennifer Weiner interviewed
you. Well, I did. I started with Jennifer Weiner, and then I had, Samantha Bee, the wonderful Samantha Bee from The Daily Show. And then Meg Wolitzer. I didn't have to read anything because I had already read everything by Meg Wolitzer. And I will be interviewed by, she wrote Prep. What's
Curtis Sittenfeld.
Curtis Sittenfeld.
Right.
I won't have to read anything because I've read everything she's written. But Ridley Pearson. I've never read anything by Ridley Pearson. What should I read?
Oh, the... An early Ridley Pearson, I think.
A
mystery.
An early mystery.
That's what I would say.
Okay, well, if you say it, if you say it.
So of the Meg Wolitzer books, the one that I loved was The Position. Did you read that one?
I read them all, except I didn't finish Belzar.
But so did you love The Position? Which is, do you remember it's about the...
I know exactly what it was about. Yes!
Okay.
Yes, it was about living with parents who are...
Who wrote The Joy of Sex, basically.
Right, basically sex.
It's my favorite of
I'm
hers.
I'm very friendly with Meg's parents, let me just say.
And her mother is a wonderful novelist as well.
Hilma Wolitzer.
Yes.
And in my hotel room in Seattle... There are a lot of books, and there is a Hilma Wolitzer book, and I took a picture of it today, and I sent her an email.
So, well, that segues into my next question, which is that, is one of the major ways that publishing a book changed for you, emails and social media that you now... Because you're so active. Every time I like
to tweet, it's true.
Yes, I do. I do, too.
You know what my husband said to me about a year or two ago now? We were out for our morning walk, and he said, if you would finish the damn book, you could lie in bed all day and tweet.
But is there... You know, I've heard from other writers that there's this expectation now.
I didn't have that. I started tweeting having nothing to do with books.
But in that interim between?
I am told that publishers do want their authors today to be active on social media. They want them to tweet. You know, tweeting is, I don't want to call it an art form, but it's its own little thing, and either it comes to you naturally or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you really don't want to do it.
Right.
You know, I like it, and I started it way before I knew I was going to write this other book. They want you to have a presence. They didn't tell that to me because,
Well, you're,
I was already doing it.
Right, right.
But
right.
I know from other writers, and it's tough, you know, and they say, you know, we want you to start this now, a year before. You,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, social media is not going away. So we had better, you know, somebody asked me the other day about social media and kids, like I'm a guru, like I know. I mean, my kids are in their 50s. Like, what should we do? And I said, well, you have to accept that it's here and talk to the kids as much as you can and try and make sense of it with them, for them.
And wouldn't that be something that you would say to almost all? I mean, what a good answer to almost any parent's question about raising children.
Yeah, well, I'm really, you all think I'm such a great parent. I am not the one to ask. I mean, you know, I was like any other parent. I made a lot of mistakes. I was young. I like to think I would do it better today, but I probably wouldn't. And they're fine.
Good.
And we love each other.
So,
my son, who used to eat his dinner under the table and call himself Frisky the Cat, like fudge, and friends would come in and say, better do something about that now before it's too late. I'm happy to tell you, he's fine. He eats at the table. He's a foodie. He loves to go out to eat. He's such a foodie.
And you can take him out to restaurants.
He's a good boy.
A good boy, good. So here's a question from the audience.
Okay.
Since 90% of this audience learned about menstruation from you.
Hang on a second.
This was given out at a event in San Francisco. They gave everyone this bag.
It says, I learned about menstruation from Judy Blume. Not know that question was coming.
No.
And I just have to say one thing. To everybody now of a certain age who is begging me to write about Margaret in menopause. No. She's going to stay 12. But Miri, who starts the new book at age 50... in 1987, 35 years after the events, she's coming back to her hometown. Miri has hot flashes.
Yes.
and for everybody who is so angry that in later editions of Margaret, the belt went and she got sticky pads or whatever, I promise you, there's a belt in this book.
Well, this question, the person who wrote this question, I think would like you to write a nonfiction book about menopause.
No, thank you.
Is there a particular character you created who you really are very fond of and daydream about their adult lives? It's a great question, I think it. I think it's...
You know, I love them all the way a mother loves her children, but I do not daydream ever about their adult lives. They are who they are in the book. They're never going to get any older than what they are in the book. You can daydream about them. And that would be lovely, but no, I don't.
When you think about books, novels that you love now, do you think about when you're living with those characters, you said when you finish a book, those characters are still part of your life. Do you think about what would happen to them after the book ends?
I do not.
No. Wow. No. Wow.
Because that story is over. I mean, I think about them in the story.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. I mean, I had to sign 18,000 tip-in sheets. Do you know what that is? Mm-hmm. They're bound into the book, so 18,000 books could be sold autograph books could be sold. We saw one in the airport the other day, right next to the donuts. That was so much fun. And so I was speaking at an audiobook lunch, and somebody said to me, well, how long did it take you to sign those 18,000 sheets? And I said, 3.5 audiobooks.
Great.
Yeah. And one of them was All the Light You Cannot See, and that was very well read. And I did find myself thinking about the characters,
the girl.
A lot after it. Audiobooks really, you know, I haven't heard an audiobook yet of this. It's out there. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost afraid to listen because everything depends on the reader.
Yes.
Everything.
Did you have input into who the reader was? Did they send you samples of different?
They did, but it was all very much rushed and they needed to do it quickly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm hoping. She read wonderfully. She read the 4-book series of the Pain and Great One chapter books.
Oh.
And she was fabulous. And she changed her voice. She was just so good. And everybody says this can't be true, but I swear to you, during her breaks, she wanted mashed potatoes for her voice. And every voice person says, that's insane. But I saw her eating the mashed potatoes. And so I really, really liked her. And anyway, she read this book. Kathleen McInerney is her name.
So your 1986 book, Letters to Judy, which was letters that people had written to you about how much your books meant to them. Do you think you still get letters today?
Yeah.
Have they changed?
Yeah, they've changed a lot because they all come by
email
now. And you know, there's something about picking up a pencil and writing down your innermost thoughts and folding it up and putting it in an envelope and licking the envelope, putting a stamp and dropping it in a box to somebody that you don't know, but that you're not afraid
to write
to tell this to.
Yeah.
And so you don't do that with email, I don't think, especially a young person, because, you know, somebody might see that at home. I still do get some of those letters, and some of them come by snail mail. There are a lot of letters, but for the most part, they are electronic.
Yeah, it's different.
It is different.
Yeah.
I get my best ideas still, always, connected to a pencil. Mm-hmm. You know, I write on a computer, I print out all the time, but I take a pencil. I do like 20 drafts. The forest will forgive me. But, you know, I use old paper.
Just a couple more questions. One of them is, without necessarily naming any names, who is the best editor that you worked with and why? Or just what was... What was, like, the best editorial decision?
I can name names here.
Okay.
I was discovered in the slush pile by Dick Jackson at Bradbury Press. And Dick Jackson was the most amazing editor. He taught me everything I know about revising. When I'm not working with him, I still hear his voice in my head. And what I learned was that he works in a different way with every one of his authors. He somehow understands what you need. And with me, he always said, you know so much more than you're telling me in the beginning. And I want that. I want you to dig. I want that. Dick Jackson also said one of my favorite lines, which was, someday, some graduate student is going to do a thesis on teeth in Judy Blume books.
And has it
happened? That's my father, the dentist. He was wonderful. And then there is Carol Baron.
Yes.
Carol Baron, who I worked with on
this book
and Summer Sisters. With Summer Sisters, I wasn't sure what I was doing who was my audience. I don't like to think about who is my audience. I just want to tell the best story I can tell. Nevertheless, it has to be for some audience. And with Summer Sisters, that book was rejected. And it wasn't that long ago by many of my publishers who had published me happily. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very painful at that point in my career to be rejected. Like, you know, the line is, well, I don't know what to do with this book. I can't make it into a bestseller, so I have to pass. You know, that's... And Carol Baron said to me, I know what to do with this book. Mm-hmm. Let me work with you. Mm-hmm. And we worked together, and, you know, it became my biggest bestseller. And so for this book, I only wanted to work with Carol. And we went through 5 years of breakfast in New York, but I wouldn't show her one word of what I had written.
Really?
Until a year ago, it was the end of May last year, and I had a draft. I know it's really hot, isn't it? I would take this off, but I don't show my arms. I'll show anything else. So I had a draft, and it was either burn it or click send to Carol. And my husband said, why don't you just click send? You can always burn it later. And we worked together intensely for a year on this book in the best way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, questions, answers, this, that. It's hard to explain how the editorial process. It's not like change this word or change that word. It's
think about this
ideas,
and how might you
it's
break.
It's bigger ideas. It's characters.
So I think this is a really fitting last question to ask you. Do you get nervous or self-conscious when writing about sex?
Not when writing about it. There's nobody around. No. No. I don't know if you heard the playlist when you came in here. The songs are all songs that are in the book. You didn't hear the music playing. Oh, you didn't hear Tony Bennett singing Because of You. There's a song in my heart. There's a very sexy scene that goes with that in the book. Yeah. I know it's a good scene if I get turned on myself. And yes, even at age 77. Yes.
That's great. So, Judy, it's for me, it's just been an absolute pleasure to finally get to meet you. And I get to talk to you again in Minneapolis in September.
I know.
So that will be fun.
I'm so excited.
We'll talk more about books. what we've been reading over the summer. But I know it's just been as big a pleasure and a joy for the audience to have gotten the chance to hear
you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Oh, you're welcome.
You're wonderful. Everybody told me she was great, and she is.
Oh.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It helps others find us. Judy Blume's new novel is In the Unlikely Event. She spoke in conversation with Nancy Pearl at Town Hall Seattle on June 11, 2015. This event was presented by Seattle Arts and Lectures. Thanks again to Kevin Mitchum for our recording. Tune in again soon for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
Worthwhile, and I can smile because of